Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. We get to talk with Sarah Key. She's a physiotherapist whose latest book is called The Back Sufferer's Bible. The book is recommended in the foreword by one of her patients, His Royal Highness Charles, the Prince of Wales. Welcome to LifeQuest Magazine, Sarah.
Thank you, Dwight. Pleased to be here.
Talk to us a little bit about yourself and how did you become interested in becoming a physiotherapist and what has happened in your life as a result?
Growing up in Sydney, my mother actually had very bad migraine and would traveled, as people do, along endless journeys and seeing different specialists with ever-increasing pills and medications and potions and also diets and all sorts of things, all of which were completely useless, until eventually she went to a chiropractor and had her neck jinked about, and she was fixed in one, which was fairly dramatic. And I remember being about 11 years old and thinking, this is pretty impressive when conventional medicine seems to have completely failed her. So I suppose I was always interested in this, but I never really wanted to be a chiropractor or osteopath. I really rather preferred the sort of more the safer conventional territory of conventional medicine. So I grew up and did physiotherapy, but I could see very quickly too, as an undergraduate, that there was pretty poor stuff going on. I mean, there seemed to me to be either very little being done with people who were suffering from back pain. Usually they were dispatched with pills and corsets and terrible things like that. Or at the other extreme, they were operated on, which to me seemed to be equally as unsatisfactory and often violently intrusive when the back just didn't seem to be working properly. And they didn't seem to be sort of careful clinical scrutiny going on. I mean, I remember being appalled, really, as much as I was aware as a bleary undergraduate. Spine wasn't looked at, their spine, there didn't seem to be any careful evaluation of the way the spine was working, and I remember thinking that I'm sure, really, that that could be done better than that. And so I remember I did physiotherapy, I'd worked for a couple of years in Sydney, and as most young Australians do, I then hit the travel route to England and went over there like the old fable Dick Whittington, and I remember thinking, well, this is where I'm going to learn a bit about the way backs work. And so I did, and then I worked in the National Health there, and then quite early, at the age of 26, I started a private clinic in the Harley Street area of London, which was the sort of grand medical centre.
Right. And so you began to get a clientele. People began to come, and they seemed to be appreciating your approach.
I just seemed to be, I mean, I was reading a lot, and I was going and sitting at the feet of the people that could teach me, but I think the main thing was that I was sort of tinkering and listening and using my instincts, which in a way I think has helped me better than anything.
Now, Sarah, you say that 8 in 10 people in the world have some sort of back pain or are sufferers in some way.
Absolutely.
Why is that happening?
It's primarily two or three main fundamental reasons. One is that we're a vertical structure, that we have this tall, willowy, multi-segmented column sitting on top of our pelvis, which is like a beautiful streamlined concertina, which bounces every time we walk. And the reason it bounces is that we have these beautiful shock absorbers between the vertebral segments called the intervertebral discs. Because we're vertical, the discs at the bottom of the column tend to compress more. Because we actually sit too much, we all are fundamentally afflicted by weak tummy walls at the front. So that this wonderful willowy column that bends and twists and bounces as we move actually gets very little shoring up support from the front. And because we actually have to do so much bending through the course of our daily activity, you know, even if it's just bending forward to get the salt, you're still bending.
Yes.
And you need the support at the front of a trim, taut and terrific retaining wall. And if you don't have it, and we notoriously don't, that retaining wall always gets weak. And the combination of those, I believe, is really why back pain is pandemic. And it really is pandemic, Dwight. I mean, it's more common now than it was when we were in earlier generations, and it's getting worse.
And that's interesting because we think about previous generations that, in fact, were doing hard labor.
And they were doing hard labor, but that was actually keeping them fitter.
I see.
And although, and we didn't live quite as long, and we were sort of tougher. I think we've gone soft, and we're actually taller now too.
Yes.
So there's a whole lot of factors working, and we're just softer.
Okay. And now, over the years, you say you began to move farther and farther away from what you call kind of the narrow view of treatment. A medical family practice doctor will say, well, I'll give you some pills that will help relax your muscles. What was the difference in your perspective of necessary treatment, and what was commonly happening?
What was happening was that there was either, well, as I said earlier, I think what was happening was that people, through lack of understanding and through this obsession with the slip disc,
yes,
there was really nothing being done. And there was, unless it could be shown that the disc was bulging, really, people were just treated with medication to take away the pain, or mm-hmm. with arthritic medication to deal with inflammation. And really, that was totally unsatisfactory. If one assumes, as I do, that the root cause of common or garden backache is simply a stiff spinal segment, then really what one needs is pulling the spine apart.
Okay.
And that can be done in two ways in particular, which I advocate. One is the squatting, so several times through the day,
all right,
you get up from your seat, you hold onto something that won't move, like a railing or a banister or either side of a door, two doorknobs, and
yes,
just squat down, just getting with your feet right together and your knees right apart, and trying to get your bottom as close to the floor as you can, and then getting your nose down between your knees, and then bouncing slightly. So,
uh-huh.
And actually, when you pull your tummy in hard, as you do that, you can actually feel your spine growing, which is exactly what we want. Now, the other extreme, slightly more adventurous, to pull the spine apart, is to lie over a back block.
Right.
But you don't need a back block. You can actually have a low stack of books. You can have, a 5-centimeter stack of books. You lie on your back on the floor with your knees bent. You lift your bottom. You slide this back block under your bottom, not your spine itself, under the sacrum, the hard, flat bone at the base of the spine. And then you let one leg go down to the floor carefully, and then the other, and so that you're actually lying draped backwards, passively draped backwards over this structure under the base of your spine. And that actually is the classic anti-sitting posture. If you imagine, Dwight, I mean, the position that you and I would be in now is one of crumple.
Yes.
We're sitting forward. I'm hunched over the telephone. You're probably hunched forward over your console there.
That's right.
And that's the way we all work. If you're driving, if you're on the computer, if you're sewing, if you're ironing, if you're doing needlework, if you're reading, we're all hunched forward. And this leads me to a fourth factor, which I didn't bring in when we spoke earlier about the fundamental three causes. If you're always bending forward, then you actually begin to lose what I call dynamic balance of your skeleton as a whole. And this is another fundamental cause, I believe, of why back pain is so common. So this lovely, simple manner of redressing that stoop is achieved by lying over this stack of books. And you do it for the tiniest time. I mean, Dwight, 1 minute a day makes a difference.
Really?
It does make a difference. And you can feel everything pulling out.
Uh-huh.
It's incredibly effective. And it's, if you imagine the number of hours that we've spent sitting, you've probably never been in that position of draped backwards over a back block once in your life.
Right.
It's beautifully relaxing. It's not the same at all. It's a completely different set of dynamics than the well-known back exercise of lying on your tummy and pushing back straight with straight arms,
yes,
which actually compresses the base of the spine.
I was wondering about that.
Actually rehydrates the discs. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind that the discs are shock absorbers. They actually work by being full of water. But because we sit too much and compress the base, they actually leach water out so that we actually have much thinner discs as we get older at the base of the spine than we do higher up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I work on the premise that by distracting the spine daily for as short a period, as I say, of 1 minute, you can actually suck fluid back into those discs and make them into the beautiful bouncing, what we call hydraulic sac, which is what they are.
We're talking with Sarah Key, author of The Back Sufferer's Bible. We'll be back in just a moment with more. I'm Dwight Lanehaw.
What you're saying, though, is here in your book that we can actually do a lot of this rehabilitation ourselves once we're instructed.
Absolutely. I mean, if the fundamental cause, I mean, we as physiotherapists can plunge our hands into a human spine, as osteopaths can, and incidentally, and as chiropractors can, and we can feel stiff vertebrae, stiff spinal segments, segments that won't move on pressure.
Right.
Now, the reason they're stiff is that the disc underneath them, the shock absorber they're sitting on, is actually inelastic because it's lacking water. And that's the fundamental. You've got to actually rehydrate the disc to actually get better separation so that then whatever else is wrong with the spine is easier to get at. And so you said to me earlier, what exercises do you do? You simply work on the premise that you've got to disimpact the spine, and then you actually mobilize the spine yourself. And they're very simple exercises. For example, one of the simplest ways that you can mobilize your spine yourself is to simply lie on your back on the floor and gather your knees to your chest, link your hands around your knees, and just tip backwards and forwards along, backwards and forwards like a rocker, back and forth over your lumbar spinal segments, the five spinal segments.
Yes.
And that is an incredibly effective way of unjamming the stiffest vertebrae. They're usually the bottom two. That is a simple technique. And even if you're having osteopathy or physiotherapy or chiropractic as well, just these fundamental simple exercises will make it so much more, will make what you have done so much more effective and so much more long-lasting.
Now, again, this is all in your book called Back Sufferer's Bible. And the author is Sarah Key. That's K-E-Y. I wanted to mention to our listeners, Sarah, that you do have a lovely webpage. It's www.sarahkey.com. A lot of information about your books and your philosophy of treatment. I found it very fascinating, and I hope that our listeners will be able to go to that. Again, the book is Back Sufferer's Bible by Sarah Key. It is available on Amazon.com. Contact your bookseller, who will be able to find out how they might order it in case it's not available. Sarah, I appreciate the time you spent with us.
And I had a wonderful time.
And
thank
I hope we can talk again.
I'm Dwight Lanehoff. I'll be back in just a moment.
Joining us today on LifeQuest, here are your hosts, Dwight Lanehoff.
Every culture seems to find expression in poetry. Sandra Haynes, who teaches English literature on the college level, talks with us about her collection of poems called Of Butterflies and Men.
So where did you start enjoying poetry, Sandra?
I think that most of us grew up hearing childhood rhymes, and there's just something akin to music and poetry because of that rhyme and rhythm, which has a primal appeal. And I think that's where I probably started enjoying the sound of poetry.
Now, there are probably some people who say, well, why doesn't a person just come out and say it? Why do they want to put it in this form?
Well, you know, when you look at poetry, I think it's a concentrated form of writing in which the writer is actually forced to be concise so that the message comes home quickly. And I think that's one of the beauties of poetry. You can read something, and there's usually a little message or something, a little point to it that will be of interest to people.
It does cause us also not to just read, but to actually listen and study and understand.
And another thing I like about poetry is that it allows a person to express deep feelings or convictions which might not find expression otherwise. And poetry, I think, is kind of an accepted medium for such thought.
You've been teaching English and literature for many years with various age groups. I know that when you were my teacher, I was in secondary school. Is that more frustrating dealing with teenagers than, let's say, college students?
I think so, because I think there's a maturity level in which a person starts to appreciate philosophy, and a lot of times poetry does express philosophy, and sometimes young people aren't quite ready for that. I find myself, as I have matured, I hope I have anyway, it seems more meaningful to me to read something like that that makes sense and expresses the philosophy of life, because a lot of times poetry does that. Think of Robert Frost and some of the things that he has written. They do teach a lesson, and I think the earlier a young person is exposed to this, they can kind of catch a glimpse of what it's all about. But, you know, if you just take a teenager who has not had much exposure to that, a lot of times it doesn't make a lot of sense to them, and they just kind of brush it off. So it does take some education.
The poetic form has existed, it seems like, for millennium.
Yeah, it does.
Now, Sandra, there are different rhythms, cadences, or whatever you want to call them in poetry. Is that kind of like music? You know, different kinds of music will bring out different emotions and things. Is there a purpose, or like if you're wanting to write a poem about something, does it help to choose the cadence or the rhythm? Does that have anything to do with it, or is it just something, whatever happens?
I don't know that I can totally answer that for everyone else. I know my own style of poetry tends to be traditional and consistently that way, you know, of rhyme and rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to write in quatrains where the rhythm is in like four beats to the first line, three to the second,
yes,
four to the third, and then three to the last. So it's 4-3-4-3. That's the pattern that I usually follow, although I have done like 3-3-3-3.
Mm-hmm.
But I seem to fall into a comfortable mode of being able to insert the amount of words that I need to express myself when I use the 4-3-4-3 pattern.
You've compiled your poems into three books, I understand.
Well, actually, two for the moment, and I'm actually working on towards a third one if that materializes.
All right. The one I have in front of me is called Of Butterflies and Men.
Right.
Poems to Ponder. Why this book and its contents?
As I look through the content of my book, the poems are largely didactic in that they are teaching poems. There's usually a point to them.
Okay.
And so the pondering, I guess, is an invitation to think about the message in each poem.
Describe the title for us and why it.
I think that kind of came from the title poem in the book, which is called Of Butterflies and Men. And, of course, everyone's heard of Mice and Men. As a book, as a novel. The first poem in the book actually deals with this subject of butterflies and man, and so I decided to name the book after it.
You know, it's interesting, the word you use, ponder, which is a favorite word of mine, but that's what really drew me into enjoying poetry in college. You know, most of the authors were dead, so we weren't right or wrong on it, but
we got
to really think and dig into that, and that became quite enjoyable for me.
Sure, because you were interpreting and putting your own slant and meaning to what you thought he meant. So you became a part of it, essentially. The book is actually in five sections.
Okay.
And I have selected some poems I thought I would share with you.
Could you do that right now? Give to us some of the ones you have selected from your book.
The first section in the book is called Reflections on Life, and it expresses just a general philosophy, my philosophy, I guess you'd say, or my perspective on life. Let me share with you the title poem, after which I named the book, Of Butterflies and Men.
Mm-hmm.
They say that a butterfly bright isn't yours unless it returns when it's freed. If this wisdom applies to people at large, its counsel we do well to heed. There's an unwritten code that's simply implied, which suggests if you hang on too tight, you'll lose in the end both children and friend, though you grasp them with all of your might. Attachment is subtle, respect must be earned, and people were made to be free. If force is applied, independence denied, it ends in futility. For what could you say to brighten the day? What could you possibly do if all of the friendships you held when released never returned to you? For friendship is fragile, in need of regard, and thrives when freedom is given. but it shrivels and fades when coercion parades and vanishes when it is driven. So open your hands. Let the butterfly go. It never was yours to keep. And if it returns and chooses to stay, you'll have a love that is deep.
What I think is very special about this poem is that it reflects attitudes and realities of the life, whatever, wherever you're from, whatever one's background is, geographically, ethnically, or otherwise. You know, countries have acknowledged the place of poetry in their heritage by having a poet laureate or someone along those lines, and that may be even unique among the appreciation of the written arts.
How do these poems come to you? Do you wake up at night? Do you say, okay, I want to write a poem about this, or are you pretty dependent on the way the wind blows, or what?
Well, that's a good question, and I've had other people ask me, and it can come from many different sources. Yes, I have awakened at night, much to my husband's chagrin, and have run to the computer or to the bathroom to scribble down a note so I wouldn't forget it by morning. Or other times, there will be a situation. For instance, I love to write about weddings, and when I go to a wedding, I have written one called The Wetting Day because it rained and, you know, almost ruined the wedding. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote one called The Sweating Day because it was so hot. And, you know, it's just situations. It's an idea. It's even a phrase that will come through my head, and I'll think, oh, I could take this somewhere. I could run with this. So it comes from many different places, and I just kind of have fun playing with the words. I had an aunt that was dying of cancer 2 years ago. And I wrote poems to encourage her in a spiritual way. And she seemed to enjoy them so much, and it seemed to give her a lift, that I thought, you know, I've written so many of these, I might as well share them. Maybe other people would enjoy them too.
Sandra, we have time for one more, and I'd like to pick it out.
Okay.
On page 54 of your book of Butterflies and Men, it's called If I Had Known. And
okay.
I wondered if you would read that to us.
Sure. If I had known the trouble that would come to you today, I could have offered words of hope to cheer you on the way. If I had known how weary your heart with care had grown, I could have spent some time with you when you were all alone. If I had known the anguish a word of mine had brought, I could have held my careless tongue, or better words have sought. If I had known the sorrow with which you said goodbye, I could have held you closer then, your unseen tears to dry. If I had known the comfort a word of mine might bring, I could have said it willingly and caused your heart to sing. Let not these words be spoken, neglect to thus condone. I would have done things differently if I had only known.
We've been talking with Sandra Haynes. Book is of Butterflies and Men, Poems to Ponder. If you're interested in a copy of this book, please write us. You'll hear the address at the conclusion of this program. Thank you, Sandra.
You're very welcome. Thank you for interviewing me.
Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net or write to LifeQuest at P.O. Box 33082, Knoxville, Tennessee 37930. I'm Dwight Lainhoff.